This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you're looking for space drama, the mission to Comet 67P has it all. First, the Rosetta spacecraft, its long 11-year journey, the Philae lander that fell into a crevice and has had spotty communication, and now some scientists are claiming there might be life on the comet, but evidence is a little bit iffy. Rosetta is one of the selected short subjects in Science this week, and here with the rest of those stories and more is Rachel Feltman of the Speaking of Science blog at The Washington Post. Welcome back, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What are they saying about the comet?
So earlier this week, a couple of scientists came out to the press and to their colleagues at a conference saying that some of the geological features we're finding on the comet, you know, its high levels of activity, the sinkholes it has, that the easiest explanation for all of those things would be that there was microbial life. They weren't saying they had direct evidence for it, but they were saying, look at all these things. Life would explain all of them.
Well, so it's Swiss cheese, you know.
But pretty much all astrobiologists were pretty upset at that line of thinking. And it turns out, as you might suspect, that life is actually the least likely explanation for all of those things on the comet, not the most likely.
Right?
Comets are really inhospitable. And even if they have some features on them, like complex organic molecules, mm-hmm. that might make life seem sort of possible, it's still really unlikely that anything could live there. And when you think about how volatile a comet is, you know, right now that comet is hurtling towards the sun and getting hotter every day. So it would be a really resilient microbe that could live in all of that comet's extremes.
Yeah.
And also the scientists who came out claiming this are people who like to cry there might be life on X pretty mm-hmm. often and are considered kind mm-hmm. of fringe. So it was kind yeah. of a lesson. And if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Well, we're going to be talking to Alan Stern later, the chief investigator of that mission. Maybe he'll have... chime in on that one.
Maybe.
All right. What else have you got for us?
So there was a new global warming study this week in Science, basically saying that the climate change hiatus, which was this supposed slowdown that a UN report came out with a couple years ago, that, you know, the water wasn't warming as quickly as we would expect it to with the greenhouse gas levels rising the way they are. This new study says the water is indeed warming at the rate we'd expect it to, but only if you look below the surface. Basically, the study says that the Pacific Ocean is really good at distributing heat at its surface, but if you take measurements deeper, you can see that the ocean is actually warming.
Hmm.
And this is interesting because NOAA actually published a study in Science a few weeks ago, also claiming that there was no hiatus in global warming and saying that it was because the data that the UN report had worked with had been faulty, that, you know, if you looked at sea temperature change data from enough different places, you would not see this slow in the trend that they had reported. So they're different studies, but mm-hmm. they're kind of getting at the same idea that when you look more closely, global warming has not slowed down.
Yeah, so there's no missing heat. It's just in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's where it's going. All right, what else have you got?
So a new cousin for the Triceratops named Wendiceratops.
Wait a minute. Wendy?
Yes, well, it's named for Wendy, I think, Sloboda. I just messed up her name, but she is a prolific...
Join the crowd.
She's a prolific fossil hunter from Canada. She's found tons of really important specimens. And the researchers who, you know, interpret these fossils that she finds were waiting for a really special one to name after her. And they told me she was really excited. She actually got the illustration of it tattooed on her arm. And the reason that it was special enough for this incredible fossil hunter is that it has this really interesting nose horn. So these horned dinosaurs, they all look pretty much the same if you cut off their heads. you know, if you lined up all their bodies, you might not be able to tell them apart. But then they were developing these really intricate horns and frills, and those were becoming really different from each other really quickly. And their scientists are really interested in how and why those features evolved in such a short time span. And this particular one has this horn on its nose that's kind of like a missing link horn. It's in between the really rudimentary small early nose horns and the really ostentatious ones that came later. And it also falls right in the middle of the family tree for its group. So it makes sense that it has this middle of the road nose horn. So they're very excited to learn more about it.
Yeah, because there are a lot of them. They're very big, those heads. If you go to the museum and you look at them, they're huge.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and they think they probably acted kind of like male goats, that they use them to, like, tussle with each other, and that it was a sexual selection thing, which, you know, tends to really speed up evolutionary change. So maybe that's why they were becoming so diverse.
Mm-hmm. Now, a few weeks ago, we talked about how the panda microbiome might not be suited for bamboo, remember that?
Right, yes. So pandas are terrible at digesting the only food they eat. They digest something like 17% of the bamboo that they consume, which is why they eat so much of it and also why they poop so much. And basically, another research group has now said, well, yeah, it makes sense that pandas are so bad at digesting their food because they've evolved to be really lazy. Their energy expenditure is basically incredibly low for their body size. They're like sloths. They apparently, their thyroid activity is comparable to a hibernating black bear. so they're pretty much just like snoozing even when they're awake.
You never see them actually running around a lot.
That's true. You see them kind of like tumble sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
So basically, they used to be carnivores. They started eating bamboo. Their gut bacteria never caught up. And instead, they just evolved to be really, really lazy.
Wow.
Something we should all aspire to.
I'll learn how to start eating that bamboo. So what are you going to be following Rosetta all next week?
Or New Horizons?
New Horizons, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, we will be pretty much exclusively covering Pluto on the blog. We're already kind of getting to that point, and I will be at APL on Wednesday. So there should be some fun stuff on the blog and on my Twitter.
It's like Pluto fever.
Oh, yeah. It's so
it?
Exciting. Well, you know, for me, it's the first time I've ever been around to see the first encounter of a planet. And that's true for a lot of people. And
yeah. Yeah, so. I remember I did Mars with Voyager. That was really spectacular.
That must have been awesome.
Too. Well, it's your turn now, Rachel.
Yeah.
Rachel Feltman, thank you. Rachel Feltman of the Speaking of Science blog at the Washington Post. Next up, time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And today's story, knowing your biological age. I mean, how old are you really? A study out this week confirms that some people age much faster than others. And the researchers calculated the biological ages of a group of adults based on things like their blood pressure and their cholesterol. And all the participants were 38 years old, but it turned out that, physically speaking, the condition of their bodies ranged from 30 all the way up to 61, 38 chronologically. So to walk us through the good and the bad of knowing your biological age, we're joined by Daniel Belsky, lead author of the study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. He's also an assistant professor in the Division of Geriatrics at Duke University School of Medicine. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Now, why would we want to know a person's biological age? What's good about that?
So I think there are three good things about being able to know someone's biological age. The first thing that knowing about biological ages, particularly in people who are still young and relatively healthy, the first thing that lets us do is start to hunt for causes of aging that is faster than we want, or even slower, the kind of aging that we would like to engineer. And being able to identify the causes of faster or slower aging may be able to lead us toward new therapies to slow the aging process. The second thing that we're able to do with measurements of biological age is to evaluate therapies that do exist that may be applied to slow down aging. So we've got scientists working in model organisms, in worms, flies, mice, who are beginning to develop new therapies that can slow aging down in these animals. The trick now is to get those therapies applied in humans to actually help us age in a healthier state. And with measurements of the biological age, we can start to test whether those therapies are working without having to wait decades for people to develop a chronic disease or a disability.
So would you start treating somebody who's biologically older with things that you would do for an older person, for example, like getting a colonoscopy earlier?
I think it remains to be seen exactly what the clear risk indications of having advanced biological age are. But certainly risk stratification is something that we might be able to do.
Okay,
so
let's
talk kinds of preventative medicine that we apply in older adults could be useful.
Interesting. So what's bad about measuring biological age?
So what's bad about knowing your biological age, I think that there are two things, one of which is that people could get a hold of the information and they could use it against you. So if your insurance company knew that your biological age was older than your chronological age, your premium might go up. Or an employer might choose not to hire you for a particularly intense job because they felt you weren't physically up to the task. So those are concerns, and the information obviously would need to be protected should it be possible to generate this information on people in the community. And then the second reason that it might be a bad thing is that it can be dispiriting to learn that your health isn't what you'd like it to be. Now, I'm not sure how serious a risk this is. Certainly, our study members who were aging faster already had a sense of it. They reported feeling in worse health. So I think it won't be too much of a surprise to most individuals to learn that their biological age is advanced. On the other hand, you know, perhaps you're a vegan ultramarathoner, you could be quite disappointed to discover that your biological age is older than your chronological age.
Did these people, when they look in the mirror, do they see themselves as older, their parents?
Well, whether they see themselves as older, we don't know. But other people do, in fact, see them as older. So we asked panels of Duke undergraduates to rate photographs of our study members as looking young or looking old. And the study members we had measured as aging more rapidly were rated by these undergraduates as looking older.
Hmm. All right. But we hope it's not 100% accurate at this point because there's a lot more going into it, right?
It's certainly not 100% accurate. There is, at this point, what we have is proof of concept that it's possible to measure variation in the aging process in people who are still relatively young, and that the measurements we take correspond to the lived experiences of aging that we understand. So physical and cognitive decline, and then an aged appearance and feeling older.
Daniel Belsky, assistant professor in the Division of Geriatrics at Duke University. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. After the break, fasten your seatbelts. We're going to take a closer look at that New Horizons flyby of Pluto, so stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Next week, a long, strange trip will come to an end. And no, I'm not talking about the Grateful Dead that happened last week. No, I'm talking about the New Horizons spacecraft quickly counting down the miles to its target, the dwarf planet Pluto, 11 years after its launch by the European Space Agency. And on its itinerary, when it gets there, passing within just 7,800 miles of the surface, shooting photos of the almost planet, the sharpest images we've ever seen. And maybe, if we're lucky, it'll send back a few clues about how our own world, our moon, and Pluto's five known moons were made. And just what are those heart and whale images on the surface made of? Alan Stern is the principal investigator for NASA's New Horizons mission and a planetary scientist at the Southwest Research Institute who've been waiting a long, long time for this moment to arrive. Welcome, Dr. Stern.
Hey there, Ira. How's it going?
How long have you been waiting?
Longer than I might care to admit, but we've been flying this baby for 9.5 years. And that's long enough. It's time to explore the Pluto system.
When was it launched?
New Horizons was launched on the 19th of January, 2006.
2006. Wow. And how long? Why is it taking so long for you to wait for that time? What was going on in all that?
That's another good question. You know, New Horizons was the fastest spacecraft ever launched in history. In fact, when I was a kid, Apollo missions were going to the moon. They'd launch at 25,000 miles an hour, and it would take 3 days to reach the moon 250,000 miles away. New Horizons did that trip in 9 hours. about 10 times as fast. And so with that kind of speed, you know that we're not dawdling. The ocean of space that we crossed from the Earth to Pluto is farther than any spacecraft has ever traveled to its primary target, 3 billion miles from the Earth.
Wow. And you've compared Pluto and its moons to, quote, presents under the Christmas tree. Is that right? Why? So, like, is it going to be Christmas morning?
It's going to be Christmas in July for the science team and for the scientific community.
Wow. Well, why do you say that?
Well, you know, Pluto's kind of the belle of the ball. Has a lot to teach us about the origin of our solar system. Has a lot to teach us about small planets orbiting beyond the giant planets. Has some things to teach us even about the origin of the Earth. And New Horizons is carrying the most powerful and sophisticated suite of scientific instruments to make a first reconnaissance ever. So that combination, giving us tremendous data sets on a rich target, unlike anything we've ever visited in the past, just creates a Christmas in July.
Yeah. Yeah. Give us an idea of what sort of schedule you'll be keeping as the approach happens. What kind of team is backing you up on this? Not just a few people at a computer, right?
Well, that's right. New Horizons was built by a team of 2,500 people across America. The Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab, where the spacecraft was built, at our place, the Southwest Research Institute, where we put together the seven scientific instruments, at various universities, at almost all of the NASA centers, and, of course, at the launch vehicle manufacturer, which is Lockheed Martin. Mm-hmm. So that big team built this tiny spacecraft about the size of a baby grand piano, a breakthrough in not just miniaturization for outer planet exploration, but a breakthrough in cost, about five times less expensive than the Voyager program, and flew it across the solar system on a very, very small team. After we got it launched and checked out, we were just operating on a few dozen people to do everything from navigation to flight control to flight planning to the science, all parts of the project. Now that we're at Pluto and we've been in this flyby since January on a long approach, 300 million miles, only about 3 million miles to go, we have staffed up. There are a lot more people on the science team. There are a lot more people. We're running operations 24/7, navigation team, etc. So right now we're running round the clock, and we will continue to do so for the next couple of weeks.
So what kind of stuff would you like to discover about Pluto? What don't we know about Pluto? It's the last stop, isn't it?
It is.
The solar system.
I like to say that we're running the anchor leg in a 50-year enterprise to make the first reconnaissance of all the planets, begun under President Kennedy in 1962 with NASA's Mariner program, and continuing through NASA's Pioneer and Voyager programs to New Horizons, which is another NASA program. And, you know, you asked, what don't we know? It'd be simpler to just say, what do we know? Because it could fill a couple of 3x5 cards. We know that little. This is true exploration. We are flying into the unknown to a place that no one's ever been before, a class of planet no one's ever been before. And we are going to write the textbook from scratch.
Let's talk about what you've seen so far. There are a couple of interesting features on the surface. The heart that's on sort of the right side, and then the whale on the left side of the planet.
That's right. We like to call those two features by those informal names. The heart is pretty distinctive. It's big and bright and shaped like a Valentine's Day heart, bright white, sitting on a ruddy kind of background that's the general color of Pluto's surface. The whale, which is an oblong feature along the equator that runs about 1,000 miles, is itself very dark as dirt. And very different from the rest of the planet that's very icy and much brighter, higher reflectivity. And we don't know what it's made of yet, but we will by next week, because we'll be close enough for our spectrometers to actually measure the composition of that material. Right now, we're a little too far out to do that because the spectrometer doesn't have enough resolution to split the ice from the dark region where the whale is. But in fact, by the time we get through the day on Tuesday at closest approach, we will have compositional measurements will blanket the surface with more than 64,000 measurements so that we can make compositional maps with a resolution of just about a few miles.
In case you just joined us, we're talking with Alan Stern, principal investigator of NASA's New Horizons mission, which is speeding toward the former planet Pluto.
Now, why would you say that, Ira? You know, a lot of planetary scientists call these objects planets.
Do you agree that it should be a planet?
Oh, absolutely. They have all the properties of planets. They know that they're big because they make themselves round due to self-gravity. And, you know, we're discovering all types of planets with missions like Kepler. You know, planets around pulsars and hot Jupiters and super-Earths. And we're learning that the diversity of planets in other star systems, as well as here at home, is different than our 20th century notions. So in planetary science, we're adjusting to this much greater diversity and variety in sizes and in compositions and in types of atmospheres. It's almost mind-blowing how deep this revolution is.
So you think, you know, maybe this mission might bring it, you know, back into the mainstream. I mean, they name planet. I'm not in charge of calling it Pluto or not. Maybe there's an organization that calls these things.
Well, actually, that organization is made up of people in a different specialty. It's kind of interesting. I'm a planetary scientist. People on my team are planetary scientists. We're experts in the study of planets. Astronomers are people who study stars and galaxies and cosmology and really don't have a lot of expertise, by and large, in the study of planets. In fact, I would say they have no more expertise in the study of planets than, let's say, comparing two types of doctors, that a podiatrist might have an expertise in neurology.
You seem to have very strong opinions about this.
Yeah, you should talk to planetary scientists. We're the experts.
Okay, I'm talking to one now. What would surprise you? I mean, this is the closest anybody's gotten to Pluto.
We are.
Yeah. What would really surprise you to find out?
You know, when you go exploring, you have to expect the unexpected. And all of the first missions, the first mission to Mars did not expect we'd find a world that had dry river channels all over it. And the first mission to Mercury didn't expect to find a world where the mantle of the planet had been stripped off. And we just pretty much have a core sitting there with a little crust on top. First time we went to the outer solar system, we didn't expect to find oceans on the insides of moons or volcanoes going off on Jupiter's moon Io. So this is such a wild and alien place. And what we already see of it, the surface geology, the variety of different moons it has, we're just fastening our seatbelt and just waiting to get up close early next week.
You know, it is fascinating that this planet has five moons, a tiny little planet at the edge with five moons.
Isn't that crazy? You know, Pluto has more moons than all four of the inner planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars.
It is crazy. And why would it have so many, and would those moons be different?
Well, we're going to find out.
Is the mission designed to go by the moons?
Absolutely. We will not only make maps of the surfaces of the moons, we will determine their composition, their reflectivity in the big moon, which is as big as the state of Texas. It's called Charon. We're going to even look for an atmosphere around that one. We're going to really get the lay of the land on this entire system, not just the star Pluto, but all five of the satellites, and we may discover more still.
More moons.
Could be. And we're going to look for rings as well.
Wow. And all within how long a time do you get to stay there? It's moving pretty quickly.
We're moving very fast. Well, we dive deep into the heart of the system on Tuesday, but we'll continue to study as we recede, as missions like Voyager did. And we'll be making very important studies for the rest of the month. We're going to collect so much data with this little high-tech spacecraft that it will take over a year to downlink it all, to get it back to the ground, because the memories are so vast compared to historical standards that New Horizons is just going to be chocked full. More than 99% of the data that we take will be on board the spacecraft after flyby, not yet on the ground. So we have a big job ahead, lasting the rest of 2015 and almost all of 2016, to send all that data to the ground. So for your listeners and for our science team and for you, this is the gift that keeps on giving. New data sets, new images, new spectra about the Pluto system will be raining down from the sky for 16 months, as if we were there and orbiting.
So it sounds like you have waited your whole career for this mission.
this is an awesome opportunity for us. You know, in our parents' generation, there was an opportunity for planetary scientists to do first missions to the planets, first to Mars, first to Venus, first to Jupiter, and so forth. In this generation, New Horizons is it. It's the one and only opportunity. There's nothing like it that's planned to happen again, and nothing like it has happened since 1989. So you bet we're excited.
And there's nothing scheduled to come up after it that's like it.
Exactly. It's the last picture show.
Pluto and Charon might share an atmosphere. Is that right?
Well, you've done your research. That's absolutely right. There are theoretical modeling papers that show that the gases escaping from Pluto's atmosphere, a fraction of them may enter orbit around its big moon, Charon, which is not very far away. They're really a double planet system. And we're going to be looking for that. We have the ability to do a very sensitive search down to pressures as low as 1/1,000,000,000th of the pressure here at the Earth's sea level to look for even the faintest of atmospheres around Charon. And if it has the same composition as Pluto's atmosphere, it's a pretty good bet that they're sharing the same one. And that would be unprecedented.
Wow. Talking with Alan Stern, principal investigator for the New Horizons mission on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. So, when is the good stuff starting?
Well, I think it's already started, and we're putting out images every day, and they're just knocking our socks off with the geology, the variety, the difference between Pluto and Charon, things like that. But next week is really where we get the goods, because we're going to get such high-resolution imaging, such high-resolution spectroscopy, thermal data sets so we can map the temperatures, stereo data sets so that we can map the surface topography on Pluto and all of its moons. That's when we'll search for Charon's atmosphere. All of that and a lot more happens Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of next week.
Yeah. Is there any concern that the software might have another hiccup on it like it had this week?
You know, I'm not concerned about that. That was actually caused by humans on the ground who tasked the spacecraft with a little bit too much to do. It's the first time anything like that has happened in the 9.5 years we've been operating the bird. And it really can't happen because that kind of activity isn't scheduled during the flyby. We've practiced and rehearsed on mission simulators that are identical to the spacecraft, and the entire flyby sequence, 9 days of computer commands, were loaded up to New Horizons in 2013 when it was between the orbits of Uranus and Neptune, and it did the whole 9-day thing flawlessly. Mm. So I'm pretty confident.
You got to stop having those guys from the New York Stock Exchange using your software.
we'll check that.
Let's check that. 1-800-999. Oh, it's the old number. 844-724-8255 is our number. I think we can get time for one call in here. George in Jersey City, New Jersey. Hi, George.
Hi.
Hey there. Quickly.
Quick question. When will New Horizons overtake Voyager as the most distant man-made object in space?
Oh, great question.
Okay, well, let me get right to it. It sounds like we don't have much time. New Horizons has the power to continue to operate for about 20 more years, so it's going to fly a long way. But although we were the fastest spacecraft ever launched, the Voyagers went to multiple giant planets and got multiple speed boosts. So in the end, the two Voyagers are traveling slightly faster than us, and we'll never catch them. They'll always hold that record.
How does the technology compare on the two?
Well, I compare Voyager to New Horizons as, you know, their 70s technology. Think of a 70s mainframe computer, much bigger, much more expensive, and not nearly as powerful as the little tablet that you have. New Horizons is kind of the tablet compared to the Voyager mainframe. Some of the capabilities that we have on board are, I hate to use the term, but light years ahead. I'll give you an example. The Voyager infrared spectrometer, the composition mapping device, had 1 pixel. Our composition mapping spectrometer has 64,000. And that, I could give you a dozen more examples of technology, because it's 21st century technology, that makes Voyager look clunky. Now, I have to say, I am a hero worshiper of Voyager. The most amazing exploration mission, I think, you know, of the 70s and 80s. And it's just historic what it's done. And they're 40 years old, and they're still operating. It's amazing.
Will you be able to follow New Horizons the same way for 40 years?
Well, throughout the rest of this decade, the 20s and most of the 30s, we think, will have the power to operate it. So if NASA continues to extend the mission, then we'll be able to communicate with it and take scientific data. In fact, we're going to propose to NASA to do another flyby 4 years after Pluto in 2019 of a much smaller building block of these small planets. We've just found it last year with the Hubble Space Telescope. Actually, we have two. We have to choose between them. We're going to propose that to NASA next year. And if they're able to do it, then that flyby would be in early 2019.
All right. Well, sounds exciting, Alan.
Thank you, Ira.
Good luck. Congratulations to you. We'll be following you next week. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Alan Stern, Principal Investigator of NASA's New Horizons mission. We're going to take a break and check in on how bumblebees are holding up against climate change. It's surprising. We'll talk about it after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Honeybees, as you've heard, aren't doing so well. Hives are being abandoned like ghost ships. A deadly brew of fungus, mites, and pesticides are taking down the bees, and a parasitic fly can sting them, turn them into zombies. Their wild cousin, the bumblebee, isn't faring too well either. And one of their biggest plights might be climate change. Researchers say some bee species' habitats have retreated up to 180 miles in the last 40 years. Their results were published this week in the journal Science. Jeremy Kerr is the lead author on that study. He's also a professor of biology at the University of Ottawa. He joins us from CBC Studios there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
You looked at how bumblebee ranges have changed across North America and Europe. Give us an idea of what's going on.
Okay. Well, what we did was we looked at 67 bumblebee species for 110 years, and we had about 423,000 observations for those 67 species across both Europe and North America. And what we found was that over time, and very much unlike many other different kinds of species, bumblebee species have not been tracking further north or into areas that used to be too cold for them, but that have warmed up. And then the other part of that range question that we looked into was to ask what's happening in southern areas and in hot places. And what we found there also is something very unusual, and that is that the ranges are kind of rolling up from the south. They're collapsing inward with increasing heat in southern latitudes. And a lot of these effects are actually happening at exactly the same pace and with very similar timing across continents.
So the bumblebee range is sort of being put in a vice. They're not moving north, but they're being pushed up from the south.
Yeah, it's kind of like they're being crushed by climate change. So if you think of a geographical range of a species, it's a sort of series of areas within which you may find a population of that species present. That looks a little bit like a big rug if you were to spread it out on a giant map of North America or Europe. And what we're effectively doing with climate change, our best measurements suggest, is kind of rolling that rug up from the south. And the net effect is that their ranges are constricting through time, but the pace at which this is happening is frankly quite alarming to us.
Give us an idea of that pace.
Well, what we're seeing is that across Europe and North America, again, the patterns are actually statistically indistinguishable. The further south you go, the more range these species have lost from those southern areas. So there's a very strong relationship between where these bumblebee species are in either Europe or North America, and how much range they have lost from the south. So in southern United States, for example, like parched, hot places like California, bumblebee species in the last 35 years after 1974 have lost up to about 300 kilometers or maybe 180 or 90 miles from the southern boundaries of their range. The patterns are just the same in the south of Europe.
Now, you're talking about an effect of climate change. How do we know that it's not pesticides or something like that?
Well, that's a really important question. And one of the things that we know from multiple lines of evidence is that pesticide impacts and habitat losses kill bees. And those facts are not in dispute, and particularly a dangerous group of pesticides which are actually designed to kill insects, called neonicotinoids, should come as no surprise that those insecticides also kill bees. Now, we measured the use of neonicotinoid pesticides and pesticides more generally across the United States, an area for which we could get very, very good data because the government in your country provides terrific access to this information and pretty much the only place that does that. So we could actually measure this. And in the very particular way that we looked at things, that is at the boundaries of where you find species, the shifts are, first of all, they began before neonicotinoids were in any sort of meaningful use in a geographical sense, so it predates the use of neonics. But we have also found that, statistically speaking, bumblebee species are, at the boundaries of their range, just as likely to have done well in places where there are lots of neonics being used as to have done badly. So statistically speaking, at the boundaries of range, we know that our effects can't be attributed to things like pesticides. But we also looked at changing land uses as carefully as data could possibly let us do, and those effects are also not what we are observing here. We're seeing a climate change-related signal.
Mm-hmm. Other pollinators, like butterflies, have been moving northward. Why are bumblebees having such a hard time moving?
Well, that's a really good question, and this was an opportunity for us to think a little bit about evolution. If you go back in evolutionary time and look at the ancestor of butterflies, that's a group of organisms whose ancestry is in tropical environments. So the evolutionary ancestor of butterflies evolved in the heat, and the species that are the daughter species of that evolutionary ancestor through time have, to a large degree, retained that ancestral tolerance for warm conditions. And as a consequence, we think, butterfly species are actually doing all right in many areas, and they're expanding their ranges to the north and so on, which is not to say that climate change is a good thing for them either. But in the case of bumblebee species, they have a very distinctive evolutionary origin. They evolved in cool and temperate conditions in Eurasia. We know that from really great research that's been conducted in the United States. And we tested for an evolutionary signal among our bumblebee species in this study to see whether or not closely related species responded in similar ways to shifting climatic conditions. And what we found is that the more closely related bumblebee species actually are, the more likely it is that they share an intolerance for extreme heat conditions.
Mm-hmm. What about the idea of assisted migration? In other words, having humans intervening in relocating the bees. Should we pick them up and move them?
So this is something that we need to have a conversation about, and I don't think anyone would suggest that we should just stop what we're doing and start moving bees north, because there may be unintended consequences, and we have to be very cautious to be aware of what we're doing. So we need a thoughtful conversation about this. But while we are conducting research into issues of that sort, we also have an opportunity to do a better job managing areas where bumblebee species are currently found. So we can think about reducing unnecessary applications of pesticides, maintaining field margins with wildflowers, which are great nectar and pollen resources for bumblebees, and planting native wildflowers in our own gardens. And all of these effects will help hold on to the pollinators and buy us some time while we come to grips with the question of assisted migration, but also the much more important problem ultimately of dealing with climate change as though we actually wanted to solve that problem.
That's a big political problem more than anything else.
It sure is.
Could climate change also be a factor in colony collapse in honeybees?
Oh, no. That's a question that I am just not qualified to answer. I would love to be able to comment on that. And to be perfectly honest, my expertise does not run very deep when it comes to honeybees.
Are they so different, honeybees and bumblebees?
Yeah, they're really different. Bumblebee species, of course, are a very diverse group. And if you look across North America, honeybee species. This is a single group or a single species that's been introduced from Europe. That's why we call it the European honeybee, Apis mellifera. And it's a kept animal. It's like sheep and goats and cattle. It is an agricultural assistant that we cultivate. Bumblebee species are wild animals, and unlike honeybees, tend to have much, much smaller colonies. So just picking up those colonies and moving them north is quite a different sort of prospect with bumblebee species, because they don't live in boxes with tens of thousands of individuals in them. Their natural history is very different, and colonies don't persist in a general sense from one year into the next.
Very fascinating. I didn't really realize the difference, but now you've made that very clear and very interesting, Jeremy. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Jeremy Kerr is a professor of biology at the University of Ottawa. What do you get when you combine three mathematicians, lollipops, and lasers? You end up with a paper called Shape Dynamics and Scaling Laws for a Body Dissolving in Fluid Flow. Say that quickly. My next guest stopped by a Willy Wonka-like lab to understand how much you can really learn from a lollipop. It's the topic of her new video for the Macroscope called The Lollipop Hypothesis. It's up at sciencefriday.com/lollipop. Oh, and in case you're wondering, we will get to that age-old question of how many licks to get to the center of a Tootsie Roll Pop. Emily Driscoll is a science documentary producer here based in New York. Emily, welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Tell us about this documentary. What
sure.
You did. You visited a lollipop factory or...
Not quite. So we visited the NYU Applied Mathematics Lab, and there the mathematicians, Jinzi Mak Wong and Leif Rostroff, are studying fluid dynamics. So they wanted to understand how the fluid dynamics of dissolving. So they didn't originally pick candy. First, they have a flow tank where they put the solid bodies, in this case the candy, into it so the water rushes over it at various speeds. And they put micro glass particles in there and shine a laser on them. So it's very dramatic, but it also helps you look at the flow, how it's moving over the candy, and it helps them see it. So originally they were going to use ice, but that dissolved too quickly.
Right. So they had to make their own lollipops.
Yes. So they found sugar can be shaped easily, but they couldn't just use just any lollipops because it had to be mathematically perfect candy. As mathematicians, they say in the video, they liked perfectly symmetrical and beautiful shapes. So when they put candy from stores into the flow tank and they started dissolving, they have all these air bubbles in it. So this would cause big chunks to fall off into the flow. So they ended up making their own candy and letting it set so there wouldn't be any air bubbles.
Mm-hmm. Now, the researchers you interviewed actually compared the way fluids erode materials to sculpting.
Michelangelo said the way he thinks about sculpting is that, you know, in every piece of rock, there's sort of a sculpture that's inside of it, and his job as a sculptor is to reveal that. And in our study, it's sort of like inside of every dissolvable material, inside of each piece of candy, is this final shape. And the fluid basically reveals that.
Yeah, so what was exciting about this study is they found that no matter what the original shape of the candy was, whether it was a sphere, whether it was a square, whether it was a cylinder, it eroded to exactly the same shape. The part that was facing into the flow was this nice curved round part. The backside, not so much. They don't really understand anything about that, but that was the exciting takeaway from the study.
Wow. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with documentary producer Emily Driscoll about our website documentary, sciencefriday.com/lollipop. So no matter what shape you start with, it all winds up looking the same way.
Exactly. It has to do with the rate of dissolve being different when they first go into the flow, because the body wants to have a equal rate of dissolve all over, uniform to the shape.
All right, now for the $64 question. This brings up the age-old question of how many licks to get to the center of a Tootsie Roll Pop.
So it's more than three, because the owl in the famous Tootsie Pop commercial took a shortcut. But what they found, they were able to build a model to formulate mathematical laws for how dissolving depends on the flow. That's the purpose of the study. So they came with this mathematical formula and found that once you have the speed and the size and some constants, you can figure out how long it takes for the candy to dissolve. And so a fluid is like licking. They found that the candy has a radius of a centimeter, with a person licking at a rate of one lick per second. So you can solve for the number of licks. And to reach the center, it would be 1,000 licks.
1,000 licks.
Yes.
Now, we've asked our listeners to try this at home, and we're hoping they'll come up and tell us how many licks that it took them.
Exactly, because this is a rough estimate since people have different saliva chemicals and different tongues. So I tried it myself and got 720.
720.
Yes, but they estimate, you know, it could be between 500 or 1,500, but, you know, 1,000 is in general what they found.
All right. This is something you can try at home if you'd like to try it. You just lick the lollipop, the Tootsie Pop.
Exactly.
Normally.
You don't need a PhD to test their results. You can go on to sciencefriday.com/lollipop, and all you need is time, a lollipop, and a tongue.
Anything, any implications beyond lollipops for this research?
Yes. This helps us understand how solids dissolve in a fluid. So this is helpful for karst landscapes. These are landscapes that are shaped by dissolving. So they have caves and underwater rivers, so we can understand more about how they form, but also how pills dissolve in the body, because the pharmaceutical industry, right, they make different pills. Some dissolve more quickly, some slower. So it has many applications.
Emily Driscoll, a science documentary producer based here in New York, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And her video is up there at sciencefriday.com/lollipop. One last thing. You know how you say there's something fishy when something doesn't really seem right? Similar sayings associating smell and suspicion exist in about 20 languages. And scientists at the University of Southern California and University of Michigan decided to test whether a whiff of fish actually affects our ability to trust information. And it turns out that it does. People in fish-scented booths were much more likely to pick out inaccurate information than those in the booth with no defined odor. And it's really about the fish, because previous experiments showed that the scent of fart spray, yes, I'm talking about fart-scented spray, had little to no effect on people's ability to trust each other. Your mileage may vary. Charles Bergwitz is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim, our associate producer. SciArts producer Annie Minoff. Luke Roskin, our video producer. Our production assistant, Becky Fogel. Our intern is Ella Fetter. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And have you seen the axolotl? It's a salamander with gills sprouting from its head. It's weird stuff. You don't want to miss this oddity of the animal world. It's our picture of the week at our website at sciencefriday.com/salamander. You can also send us email when you're on the website, and listen to back editions of Science Friday right there as our podcast. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.